This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For decades in 20th century America, retirement looked pretty darn good. Social Security, a pension, a well-deserved place on the links or at the pinochle table. People looked forward to it. Today, retirement can look downright terrifying. Pensions out the corporate window. Social Security, who knows? The affluent wonder if they'll still be able to go fly fishing in Montana. Millions of others wonder, or should, how they'll eat. With two-thirds of future retirees projected to live in poverty or just scraping by. And everybody wonders about the number, the stack of dollars they need to pack away to make it through. Up next on Point, One Man's Story and the Country's author Lee Eisenberg and The Number. Joining me now from Chicago is Lee Eisenberg. His new book is The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life. Lee Eisenberg, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So here you are. You're a good editor. You spotted it in your own life and in the lives of others. You wrote a book about it. It's a bestseller. Everybody's talking about it. What do you make of the response you're getting to the book, Lee?
Well, you're making me nervous all over again by bringing up the question of my own number.
Not so nervous. Newsweek says you're worth $5 million plus. Don't be too nervous.
I didn't confirm that, did I?
No, you didn't. I'm just
And we'll talk about talking about the number. Just because I think people ought to talk about it with loved ones doesn't necessarily mean you have to talk about it with Newsweek.
Yeah.
But obviously, my own life, this is not a book about my own life, although it was triggered perhaps by many of the fears and anxieties that I was feeling over the years. Nor is it a book about financial advice. I hope listeners are clear about that. I am not a financial advisor and perish the person who takes any financial advice that I inadvertently give.
Though you talk to a lot of financial gurus along the way, but it's more than money you're trying to look at here.
It's more than money, and it's really a book about why we are swimming in so much financial advice and so much financial information, and yet we don't take that advice. Why is that? Why are we so closed down about this subject, which can be very harrowing, as you mentioned?
Talk to us about how people are receiving it. When you go out, you've talked a lot in the last month about the number. I'm sure you anticipated how this book would be received.
Well,
what do you think about it? In fact, how it's unfolded?
Well, for better or worse, the book came out on January 3rd, and over the past four weeks, there isn't a day that doesn't go by that there isn't a really scary headline in the newspaper, and this is, I think, one of the reasons the book is being talked about and read. Just over the last several weeks, as I'm sure you're aware, IBM announced a major change in how it was going to offer its retirement plans to its employees.
Basically dropping pensions, going to 401k. Alcoa did pretty much the same thing,
aluminum company. It was just the latest in a line of a great many companies, but I think, as some have pointed out, it was something of a tipping point. Suddenly, here was a healthy, robust icon of an American company that was not dealing out of weakness, but obviously felt that it could no longer sustain the kind of retirement program that it had. Last week, GM announced that it was capping its health care benefits for hundreds of thousands of retirees. Mm-hmm. Week before that, the Commerce Department announced that the personal savings rate in this country was the lowest since 1932. All of this, of course, coming at a time when there are 76 million baby boomers out there who ought to be saving, who ought to be understanding what to do with those retirement funds, who ought to be feeling more secure about Social Security, and none of that is happening. So here comes this book out that works through many of those issues, particularly from the emotional side.
Mm.
And I think for that reason, it's gotten a fair amount of attention.
You were and are one of those boomers. To help us kind of gauge the way you look at the number, give us that life story in a nutshell, that move from fancy New York editor to something betwixt and between and then out to Wisconsin. Share that with us, Lee Eisenberg.
Okay, however erratic that may sound. For the better part of 20 years, I worked at Esquire, where I was the editor, and when I started thinking about those years in this book, I realized that they were basically the lost years, as I call them, as far as my own financial planning was concerned. You know, I had absolutely no trepidation about picking up the telephone and calling Truman Capote or Nora Ephron or any other, you know, great American journalist or literary figure and asking them to write an article. But whenever my my broker called, I found myself diving under my desk and telling my my assistant that I was in a meeting. And I, as far as that poor man was concerned, I was in a meeting for the better part of 20 years.
Because you didn't want to know? Because you weren't packing it away like
because
you
I didn't,
felt you should?
Certainly I was procrastinating. And I also didn't understand much of what he was trying to sell me or how he was going to make money off what we what he was trying to sell me. He always had some incredible product that he wanted to talk to me about. Some sort of derivative. It could only go up. It could never go down. There were all these features. There were wing nuts and collars and everything else attached to it. And it was a lot easier for me to deny the conversation, avoid the conversation, than it was for me to simply ask him, okay, what exactly is this in plain language? And even more to the point, how do you make your money if you say there are no fees attached to it? Mm-hmm.
Even so, by your mid-50s, you were doing something different. You felt you had enough security that you weren't doing a full-time gig anymore.
Yeah, we were, you know, we were comfortable. We were not Dennis Kozlowski or Dick Grasso comfortable, but we were living in a nice house outside of New York City. We had two small kids. I was in my early 50s. We had a Sub-Zero, but now and then I would have this terrible sort of anxiety that I might wind up one day living in the carton in which that refrigerator came in. Whenever I wrote out a property tax check, which are not small in the suburbs of New York, I felt a pang. Whenever I felt a some sort of fleeting heartburn, I was convinced I was immediately going to be dead of a heart attack in the next 5 minutes. And I kept asking myself, you know, did we have enough for me to be so casually employed? Even though I was doing what so many of us dream about doing, which was, you know, we used to call it semi-retirement, but now we have a new fashionable name for it. It's called downshifting.
Right.
But anyway, that's what I was doing. And then one day I got this call totally out of the blue from the man who was the vice chairman of Land's End. Mm-hmm. And he said, how'd you like to pick up stakes with your family and move to Wisconsin? As most of my friends, I think, would attest, if you had put a gun to our heads and said, where's Wisconsin? On a map of the United States, we would have pointed to Minnesota.
I don't know. We know right where it is here, but you didn't, and Dodgeville outside Madison.
Yeah.
But yet you were drawn. You were drawn because you wanted to dip back into the money scene?
Well, two things. One, I thought maybe I did have to dip back in because I wasn't obviously feeling confident enough that we had enough for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. You know, we're all living longer these days.
Yep.
And then the other thing, though, and I confess this was not something I was aware of at the time, but after spending 5 years at Land's End in Dodgeville in an extraordinary corporate culture, I came to the realization that I simply was not ready to be downshifting. I think few of us are. And the fact that I was able to get engaged again and work hard again and be productive and useful again really taught me a lesson that was about as rewarding as in fact, you know, making a little more money for the nest egg.
So what's your bottom line? We're going to talk about a lot here, but are you saying Americans go for the number, that is, figure out what you need and save it come hell or high water, or be like me and work longer, maybe forever?
Well, I think the one thing I'm saying, first of all, is that I think a great majority of us simply procrastinate and don't deal with either the financial reality of it. How much do we really need? But then the other point, which is really the point to which the book builds, is what do we need it for? You know, if you ask most men anyway that I knew in New York, what do you need all this money for? You know, their answer tends to be, well, I want to play golf 7 days a week, as if playing golf 7 days a week is going to afford them two or three or four decades of real fulfillment and satisfaction. One of the things that I really came to learn in researching the financial part of the book was that most of us are not looking at the emotional side of the equation, the what do we need it for question. And as I'm sure we can get to talk about a little bit later, until we get closer to that answer of what do we need it for, really, it's very, very difficult to do a financial plan that is really customized to each of us, that really is right for each of us. And, you know, it may turn out after asking that question, what for, is that we may need actually less money than if we don't ask ourselves that question,
you know,
when we just assume a life of ongoing acquisition.
I'm looking at these numbers that say it may be a third of Americans retiring in the future will live in poverty, and another third just scraping by. I mean, people may need that number for food and shelter and warmth in the winter.
Absolutely, and there's no denying that, and particularly with the issues surrounding Social Security, as far as those people are concerned, it's a profoundly important and frightening question. But even people who are more blessed, I mean, people who are middle class, upper middle class, or downright, you know, loaded, still are not necessarily facing up to this. You know, 40% of Americans are saving nothing. There was that savings rate, that unbelievably low negative savings
negative,
rate that I referred
yeah.
to that I referred to a little bit earlier. Even those people, and this is, you know, I did talk to hundreds of people around the country and dozens of financial planners, but even those hardy few, those determined few who actually have gone to the trouble of doing a formal retirement plan for themselves, most of them admit to not remembering what they were supposed to do. They, you know, they basically take this leatherette-bound document and put it behind the piano and don't look at it again because it's a little bit too demanding, and it expects them to rein in their spending and ramp up the savings, and they're simply not ready to do that.
Lee, at some level, it seems just dead simple. We get all the way back to your appendix, and you say, well, look, here's what you're going to need. You're going to have to live on 4% of whatever you've put away. So if you feel like you need $100,000 to live on in retirement per year, you've got to have $2.5 million socked away. Simple as that. I guess $50,000, cut it in half. $200,000, double it. That doesn't seem so complicated.
Well, it is complicated, and there's actually more to even to that 4% number that you mentioned. The 4% refers to if you retire at age 65. We're not talking about, you know, if you early retire at 50. But
yep.
if you retire at age 65 and if you have a reasonably well-apportioned portfolio, meaning, you know, as most financial planners will say, 60% stocks, 40% bonds or something in that
mm-hmm.
neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
and if nothing extraordinary happens, then at least historical market returns would suggest that you will not outlive your money if you stick to that 4% rule. Having said that, there really are no immutable laws or rules to this, which I know some people are very frustrated with. When I finished the book and I spent, you know, upwards of 280 pages talking about why this is a somewhat complicated calculation
mm-hmm,
to make, and, a couple of people read the book and said, love your book, but, you know, don't be naive here. There isn't anyone who won't walk into a bookstore, you know, with a cappuccino in one hand and with the other hand, turn to look for that one page, that graph, that diagram,
right.
that worksheet.
Right, fill in the worksheet.
That will tell each and every man or woman in America how much he or she needs to retire. And I said, well, I just wrote 280 pages saying why that it's a little more complicated than providing that worksheet. And yet there was still pressure for me to provide something. So, yes, at the end of the book, there is a what I call a quick and dirty formula for figuring it out. But I hasten to add that it is just that. It's quick and it's dirty, and it is no substitution for real planning or real introspection.
So you've thought a lot about it. You've talked with a lot of people about it. I mean, even just at the numbers level, there are many pieces in play here. What kind of return you get on what you've saved, what's actually going to be the value of your home, health costs, all kinds of things.
How long are you going to live?
How long are you going to live?
Are you an aggressive investor?
Mm-hmm.
Are you a timid investor?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that you should leave something for your kids?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that leaving something for your kids is the worst possible crime that you can commit upon them? I mean, the variables are absolutely endless, which is why it is so perhaps difficult for people to actually sit down and really start working through some of the tough questions. You know, oddly enough, maybe not oddly enough, but, you know, a year and a half into this, I began wrestling with what I now think back was the most daunting creative challenge to the book, which in the end is, you know, the punchline here is money, you know, doesn't buy happiness. Now, that as an end to any book is no better a final sentence than it was a dark and stormy night is a first sentence to any book.
But it does buy groceries.
It does buy groceries and roof and health care. I mean, you haven't even mentioned that.
Right.
And that's the biggest risk of all.
Let's look at the other side of the ledger. We'll come to that. But just that you've got a big alternate side of the ledger here, which is all about not how much money, but what you want to do with this time, which intersects with money at some point.
Yeah, and I somewhere along the line, I realized that one of the reasons a lot of us don't like to plan is because, well, obviously we don't want to think about being old. We don't want to think about dying. We don't want to think about being sick, so we don't plan. But I think another big reason we don't plan is a lot of us don't know what we are planning for. And there's a growing movement within the financial planning business. People are beginning to call themselves life planners. Now, I'm very skeptical and cynical about that term. At least I was. To me, a life planner was somebody who came to my house and helped me organize my closet. But there's a hearty band of really smart financial planners who believe that you really need to start with this question of what are you planning for? And one of the more interesting things I did over the past couple of years was to attend a workshop. It was given by a man named George Kinder, who's from Cambridge, and really believes that what he calls life planning is financial planning done right, and that in the next 5 or 10 years, it will become financial planning. And basically, I took a workshop, very intense workshop with him. There were 90 financial planners and me. Kinder has a number of really very interesting exercises that he put us all through, one of which was we sat there for an hour learning how to breathe. And it was, you know, an exercise right out of yoga practice. And everybody was beginning to get a little sort of quizzical about this. Why are we learning to breathe? And it's Kinder's thought that until a financial planner learns to breathe properly, that financial planner may not know how to listen carefully to what a client really wants out of the second half of life. And unless you can listen carefully to a client, he told these planners, you won't know what they really want, and you may not be able to sort of help guide them to the right second half emotionally or financially.
Yeah.
And then the other thing he did, and I won't get into it here because you really need to be locked in a room for 3 days to be softened up enough to take this exercise. You can't do it over the radio. But he has a signature exercise that involves asking yourself three questions. The last question is basically a question designed to get at this question of, you know, what do I need it for? And he said, until you find the answer to that, you're really basically just going through the motions of developing a retirement plan that may not be perfectly suited to you.
What do I need it for? I mean, at the end here, you've got the moral that an unexamined life may or may not be worth living, but it's always more costly than an examined one. On the other hand, I keep thinking about, yes, you need to breathe, do a little yoga, do some introspection. Yet for a lot of Americans, this may be a kind of life and death poverty issue. You describe, as you got closer to understanding what was going on here, sitting with over drinks with friends in Paris, with a friend who mountain bikes in Bhutan whenever feels like. But this is not a guy who's up against a poverty scenario.
Isn't. And there are books, and there will be books about what is obviously the more profoundly worrisome thing, which are those great millions and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people who can't be so self-indulgent as to think about some of the things we're talking about today. I'm not denying that. What I am addressing in this book, though, are the people who do have the means, who do have the time or might have had the time to be able to get much more literate and closer to what you described at the front of the show, which is the so-called new rest of your life, in which you and I are responsible for our futures. The old support systems are dead or dying. And yet these people, these privileged people, are also not in the main dealing with the question.
Lee Eisenberg is my guest. His new book is The Number. Lee, let's start to talk to some of the people who want to think about that, maybe for a change. Andrew's calling from Boston. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I had a question. I'm a mid-20-something. I'm still looking for fulfillment in my current career. How do I think about what the landscape will look like in 40 years? What will I, you know, where do I even begin to start?
Pretty daunting to try and look all the way out there. Lee, how do you advise the 20-something?
Well, but you know, a lot of the financial planners I talk to, including a lot of the 20-somethings I've talked to, basically say that people in and I'd love to hear the caller's thoughts, basically do understand that there may not be a Social Security check in their future, or if there is one, it won't bear much relation to what we've known it to be. I think you start by simply saying all the rules have changed, that there was this old rest of your life in which people were out there, institutions took care of you, and now there's a new rest of your life in which nobody will take care of you. And begin to get, the other thing is to begin to get comfortable with financial personal financial management. You know, a lot of people lack confidence that they know how the game works. A lot of people don't know differences between a stock and a bond, even that basically. A lot of them don't know why the price of a bond may go up when interest rates go down and vice versa and so on. There is a refusal to get into even the superficial muck and mire of the mechanics of money management. I know, you know, in the business that I came from, you know, writers, journalists, artists, designers, not to generalize, not only didn't understand how money works, some of them told me that they went into those fields because they wouldn't have to much worry about making money, that it sort of got them off the hook. So they never really understood the, you know, the basic, you know, the fundamentals of money management. So my advice is twofold. One is, you know, you're going to have to do it yourself. It's your boat that will have to get you to the sunset. And then the other thing is, if you've got a some sort of fear about money, anxiety about money management, or just feel like a financial nitwit, then it's time to start understanding how it works.
Andrew, how's it feel? You're in your 20s. You're looking way out and trying to imagine how to prepare for that. What are the big challenges you see right now? Is it just saving something every week, every month? Is that the challenge?
Well, that's not necessarily the challenge for me. I'm lucky to have a good career and, enough income to do some savings in 401ks, the Roth.
Good for you.
The rest of it, but it's now making sure that I guess I have enough nest egg to so that when 40 comes around that I can still make decisions and hope and have some faith, I guess, that that it'll work out.
Have you begun to do a calculation? Have you ever sat with a calculator in a long, great big calendar here?
I have, but it's so hard to know. You know, I'm single right now. You know, I don't know if I'll be married or if I'll have kids. You know, the variables are so drastic that it's even hard to know.
Yeah, absolutely. Lee?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that occurs to me as I'm listening to this is I think a lot of people are like Andrew. They assess their situation today. And then they ask themselves, all right, what is my situation going to be at 40? Or what is my situation going to be at 65? As if there is not a process that takes place day to day, year to year, decade to decade between 25 and 65. I guess what I'm saying is that you don't know where you'll be at 40. You don't know. You can't know how much you'll need at 40. And you won't know what you might want to be doing at 65. But if you begin to sort of get into this, the custom of being comfortable with managing your money, of being, as you're doing, very smart about taking advantage of 401ks and whatever else might be available to you, and then continuously, or at least now and then, ask yourself, am I on the right track financially, as far as I can see? And am I also beginning to think about what really might matter over the second half? And presumably, if you do that for, you know, 40 years or 30 years, my guess is you will be very, very comfortable with whether or not you have enough money. You'll know or confident, and you may well also be confident that you're heading in the right direction in terms of making the most out of your last, you know, two or three decades.
If you make enough and save enough and nothing intervenes. Andrew, thanks for your call. Michael's calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Lee. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I just bought your book a couple days ago, and I've gotten through maybe the first 20 or 30 pages of it. It's nice to speak with you. My question is, I'm one of those folks, I'm 36, and I've had a nice 15-year career in real estate, and I bought a lot of it, and I did really well with it, and I have nice assets for my age, but I'm one of those folks that saves 90% and spends 10%. Anything less than that, and I get concerned, you know? And so why am I the one who's worrying so much about, you know, what's around the corner or what the future holds or what I'm going to need, when my friends who, you know, save a fraction of what I save aren't as concerned about it? Why am I so concerned about it is the first part of my question. And the second part is, who wants to wait until they're 65 to retire?
Well, there's a couple of big ones. Lee.
You said you were one of the folks who saves 90 and spends 10. You are the only folk, I think, out there who saves 90 and spends 10. But to the more important question, why are you worried? I don't know why you're worried. You have to begin to figure out why you're worried. And that really is, I guess, the whole point of that last third of this book. You know, a lot of people, you know, Freud told us that much of life revolves around sexual issues that we may or may not have had, you know, with our parents and similar things. But here we are living in the most, you know, materialistic and consumption-driven society in the history of mankind. And very, very few of us go back to why we carry these knots around in our stomachs or in our heads about money. You know, I don't know why you're worried about it, but, you know, one of the things that some of these life planners suggest that we all do is to go back and begin to examine what is it that shaped your views about money that might make you more fearful than all of your free spending friends. You know, what were you told around the dinner table? What were the platitudes and homilies or cliches that you heard when you were a kid? Did you accept those? Did you accept those a little too literally? Are you rejecting them? Are you rebelling against them? We don't often go back and try to unknot the attitudes that we have about money. So what we tend to do is we blame a lot of things on money that's not money's fault. You know, broken relationship, well, it was a question of money. Mm-hmm. We were always fighting about money. Mm-hmm. But it may not have been money at all. Money may have been a stand-in for something that one hasn't bothered to try to figure out. And I think the question that you asked me is probably the best possible question that you should ask yourself standing in front of a mirror. The good news is you're saving and you probably won't have money problems. The more difficult question, though, is why are you not confident? I don't know. Maybe Tom knows.
I don't know, Michael. I hope the worry works for you, Michael. I hope it floats your boat like crazy. On the other hand, Lee, Michael's looking around at friends who aren't saving. He's kind of worried for them, maybe worried for the country. That may not be a bad idea. You saw that negative savings rate. Is anybody going to be able to be comfortable all alone with their number when there's a real national issue here? Let me get another call before the break here. Marianne's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Marianne. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
We're good. What do you know?
My husband has hoarded the book Numbers, and he's really having a great time with it, so I haven't seen it yet.
Right.
I'm entering my fourth career, which is financial planning. I'm 51 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I don't plan on ever retiring. And that's not because I have to continue to work. It's just a lifestyle choice. My husband and I both enjoy work. But at the same time, what we've done with our sons who are in their 20s is my husband and I have invested in real estate in our lives. We don't hold a lot, but our income from it should be a good addition to what his retirement is.
Good for you.
My two sons, though, have just started in their careers. And just this year, my husband and I decided that if they want to be cut in on the real estate that we would like to pass on to them, they need to take an active participation in it by putting some money away in IRAs for themselves, and then they can come in on future deals with us to invest in property through self-directed IRAs.
So you're teaching by example and by requirement. That's passing on the lesson with a vengeance, but also it sounds like something to pass on there, Marianne. There's a voice I want to invite in here, if I may. Joining us from Boston is Alicia Monell. She's director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, member of the President's Council on Economic Advisors from 95 to 97. She's written and thought a lot about retirement and American savings. You cite her, Lee, in your book. Alicia Monell, thanks a lot for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's nice to be here.
What do you hear in this conversation and in Americans' conversation in general around retirement? Lee's talking about the number. Is the whole kind of national consideration of this a realistic consideration?
Oh, I think the focus on how we're going to survive in retirement is really crucial to everyone. I just did an exercise before I got on the phone, because I think Lee and I sort of divide up the population in the sense that he is focusing really on the top 10% of households. I was looking at census data, and basically, if your family has a household income above $120,000,
mm-hmm.
then you're in the top 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And so he worries about that group, and I'm basically focused on the bottom 90%. And the bottom 90% just face a whole different slew of choices than those that he very entertainingly writes about.
So let's say you're in that 90%, that your household income is below $120,000 a year. How can, how should all those millions of people think about the number?
I mean, I think that they've got to recognize not that they're not going to get anything from Social Security, but they're going to get less than they have before, and that probably the only other pile they're going to have is their 401k plan. And as we have talked before, people's performance in 401k plans is very bad. And when you look at what people actually have as they approach retirement, we have very good numbers on that from surveys put out by the Fed. And basically, most people, not the top 10%, but most people have their house, they have Social Security, they have some pension, and they have under $50,000 of financial savings.
You've written, or I've seen the numbers, workers approaching retirement, that is age 55 to 64, this is a couple of years ago, had an average of $42,000 in their 401ks. The assumption there was that they ought to have $300,000. Lee's talking about millions. I also have seen there's about a 9 or 10% poverty among those retired now. I've read you predicting, Alicia, that it's going to be a third in poverty for those future retirees and another third just scraping by. That is not a pretty picture. Can Americans save their way out of that picture?
Well, a lot of the poverty occurs not at 65 when people just retire, but as people go through their period of retirement, especially women end up often poor. And I think a third today of women, single women, are either poor or near poor. So going forward, it's going to be a big concern because you've got these three things happening. You've got Social Security providing less. You're having people not saving enough in 401k plans. And then you have big increases in longevity. And, you know, a third of the women are going to live into their 90s. And so this and we're retiring at 62 or 63.
So is this a car wreck in the making? Are we going to have whole hordes of oldsters, begging in the streets?
Well, life is never that sharp. But I think what's going to happen is people are going to get to their early 60s, a time where their sort of options are narrowing and where they should be secure, and instead are going to say, oh, my God, I don't have enough to maintain my standard of living. They're going to figure out then that they're going to have to keep working, and they're not going to have planned to continue their career. They're going to be sort of scurrying to find any sources of additional income. So it's not, we're not going to fall off a cliff. We never fall off a cliff. But instead of having sort of a dignified period of secure retirement, people are going to just be cobbling together a whole array of sources of income to support themselves.
Alicia, stick with us. And Lee Eisenberg, Heather's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Heather. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am 28. My husband's 33.
Mm-hmm.
Collectively, we don't make more than $50,000 a year right now.
Okay.
Hopefully, that's something that will change.
Mm-hmm. But right now, you're in that 90% that's not topping out over $100,000, yeah?
Exactly. And we are able to save some. It's a little, but we are able to save. And we do think very much about how we can start planning at this point for what is to come down the road, especially because we don't see huge dollar signs in either of our futures.
Right.
But what I have found very frustrating and difficult is that I'm having a hard time finding financial advice for people in our income bracket.
Yeah.
And I have been told by several planners, well, we deal with six-figure incomes, and we can't really help you. And so I guess my question is, where can we go to get advice for the current situation that we're in? And what's the smallest thing that we can start to do at this point?
Let's turn to Lee Eisenberg and see if we can help you right now and also point you. Lee, what do you say to Heather and the other 90% that Alicia talks about?
It's a great question. A part of the book I talk about exactly that, which is to say, unless you have a lot of money to begin with, the usual places where you might turn for financial advice, the big mm-hmm. mutual fund companies and so on, basically will shake your hand and then direct you to their website because they feel there's not enough profit in you to give you face-to-face advice, presuming that advice was sound and competent to begin with. If you don't have enough money for a financial advisor, it's extremely difficult to know where to turn. And then even within the financial advice world as a whole, it's extraordinarily foggy. There are 20 or 25 or more different designations that you might see on a business card, CPA, CFA. They go mm-hmm. on and on. It's a whole alphabet soup. And most of us, including people who are very well educated and successful, do not understand the differences among those designations, don't know, very hard to know which of those designations has committed itself to signing a fiduciary oath that vows not to put their own interests, financial interests above yours or disclose financial conflicts. It's extraordinarily foggy. And I think that's another reason that a lot of people typically won't pick up a phone or walk into an office, because they're not exactly sure who they're dealing with or whether that person is going to be competent or even ethical.
So what's your advice directly to Heather here? She's trying to grapple with this. It's hard to find advice out in the world.
I do think there are independent financial advisors. I think if you do go to the big institutions, you will probably get the response that Heather's talking about. However, there are, by the hour, generally independent, certified financial advisors who will take you on. In fact, there's a very interesting woman in Kansas who's actually trying to, if you will, bring competent and independent financial advice to the masses by opening, if not a string of storefronts around the country, then at least designating individual planners who you can go to, as this entrepreneur says, with no greater momentous purpose than going to have your teeth cleaned every year, which is you go in, you buy an hour or two of advice. If there's a transition or change happening in your life, you can seek another hour of advice if you're nearing retirement, you know, and so on and so forth. Now, obviously, that's, you know, that may or may not be enough, but chances are the advice you'll get will be honest. And with time, we'll probably begin to make you a little bit more comfortable. But there's no question that the big financial services companies are not set up to offer face-to-face, personable advice to somebody who doesn't qualify as a so-called high-net-worth individual, which is what they call them.
And Alicia, what about Heather and her husband under $50,000? Does this picture add up? Are they going to be able to, you know, live with the cost of living today and save for the number, as Lee Eisenberg would put it, that will take them comfortably through retirement?
I would argue with Heather that, Heather, I don't think you need a financial planner. Does either of your employers provide a 401k plan?
My husband's does at this point.
So the only financial advice you need is, you know, put as much money as you can in there. Your husband's employer probably has a match. You get the money you put into that plan is not counted for tax purposes. It's the best way to save. And if you do it today and you keep doing it and you don't cash out, then that will provide you with a goodly sum when you get to retirement.
Will it be enough to retire, Alicia, or is this a sucker's game?
If Heather and her husband put it in, because you know a lot of people don't bother joining, mm-hmm. and if they put in as much as they can, if they put in at least up to 6% and their employer matches 3%,
okay. yep.
and they don't cash it out,
mm-hmm.
it'll end up fine. The problem is people, you know, don't join, they don't put in as much as they can, and they cash out.
Mm.
So I don't think, Heather, I don't think you and your husband need a whole lot of expensive advice. I think you've got a savings mechanism at your disposal, and I think all you need to do is take maximum advantage of that.
Don't carry debt, and put as much in there as you can, and we wish you luck, Heather. I want to get a call from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Pete's on the line. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make some comments and some observations. I started out like your last caller, and am pretty much self-taught in the financial area, and it can be done, and there's plenty of free information out there. I saved as much as I could, which didn't mean I saved a lot, and when my wife and I got near retirement, we put a plan together we thought sort of balanced with our resources. But I think even more important that since we've been retired, we keep looking at the plan and adjusting it. We keep looking at the finances and adjust it. It's sort of an iterative process.
And how's it working out for you, Pete? Do you feel secure?
Yes. Yes. And I don't consider myself in the top 10%, probably somewhere in the middle of that lower 90%.
And what portion of your pre-retirement income are you living on? Do you have a handle on that?
Probably about 75 or 80%.
I would think that's pretty good, Lee. If you can get to 75 or 80% of your working life income, is that a good target, Lee?
It's a good target, and I really loved what the caller said about this iterative process. As I was trying to make that point earlier,
mm-hmm.
this is
mm-hmm.
not something you need to sort of sign off on for the next 40 years. This is something that should be part of your, if not daily life, then part of your weekly or monthly life. I just want to say one other thing too about Dr. Minnell's absolutely golden advice about the 401k. There's one other piece that I would like to add to that, which is, yes, start one, and yes, maximize the match and all the rest. But you also have to make sure that you're doing the right thing with it, and which is to say, you're not putting it into your own company's stock, which is obviously the WorldCom, Enra, and that you're apportioned properly. This is not rocket science. The industry tends to make it extremely mysterious and complicated. But basically, as we're now beginning to learn, there are these things called index funds. They do not take big, huge bites out of your nest egg in terms of fees and commissions and transaction costs. They're very, very inexpensive. And if you properly allocate that 401k between, you know, stocks and bonds, looking at them iteratively as you get older, making sure the balance is right between stocks and bond index funds, then I absolutely agree with Dr. Monell that that we should be okay.
I see a couple more really good points in from our callers here, and I want to get to them if I may. Let's get them back to back. First, Marie in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Marie. What do you have to say?
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I started this call before the woman came into the conversation, so she touched on some of my points because I have not read this gentleman's book, and I don't intend to buy it because I really think he's addressing that top 10%. And also, I think the whole discussion is being taken out of context. We are living in a country that controls a lot of our finances. And things can change. We have no control over them.
The president says, take control of ownership society. Take ownership of your future.
That's what this person is promoting, this administration's philosophy.
Is there a problem with that? What's your option here?
I have a problem with it. Yeah, I have a problem with it because it also rings true that this was done internationally with the World Bank. You go out and let people bury themselves in debt. And then you expect them to save when they hardly have enough money to put on the food on the table.
And you kind of feel like you're on your own. So there's a question on the ownership part of this, and I want to get one more caller if I may. Jerry's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
We're well. What do you think, Jerry?
I have to take issue. The lady said that you're supposed to save all your money in a 401k plan. My problem with a 401k plan and also a traditional IRA is the fact that you're using before-tax money. And later on, when you're an annuitant, when you're taking money from the plan when you're retired, the money comes out at the current tax rate.
Which could be very high down the road when all of our deficits come home to roost.
To fuel my argument, I have to add this. In 1932, income tax came into being. And the reason income tax came into being was to pay the debt off for the Civil War.
And I don't know the details, but it could happen again. Our time is short. Let us pick those up. Lee, first to you. The first caller says, ownership. I can't own this. It's too much for me. And Jerry says, taxes are going to be so high when you pull this out, you're going to get crunched.
Well, I'm still smarting from the implication that I'm somehow a paid spokesman for this administration, which I am decidedly not. You know, the fact of the matter is the world changed in retirement planning a quarter century ago. When these plans were first introduced. And I think one of the problems is nobody issued a press release to tell us that the rules were changing, that we were moving from basically the support systems we've talked about to this new age of self-determination. I am not advocating that. I'm simply suggesting that everybody accept the fact and the reality that we are now living in that world.
We've got half a minute. Is it going to add up for what percent of Americans?
I'll defer to Dr. Monell if she's still on the phone.
Alicia?
Yeah, no, I'm very concerned about everybody below the top 10% because even though the higher end there are not going to starve to death, I think if people continue retiring at 62, and keep saving in 401k plans as inappropriately as they are right now, and with diminished Social Security replacement rates, and basically not saving anything else on their own, that everyone is going to feel like they're not going to be able to maintain their lifestyle in retirement.
Well, there's the fear factor. That motivates us. If that doesn't motivate you to suck it away, I don't know what will. Lee, do you come out of this conversation? We've got half a minute here. With Americans you've had in the last month, optimistic about them buckling down to this or still not so sure?
I'm guardedly optimistic that people in their 20s and 30s are finally getting the point that they're going to have to begin to take care of themselves. I'm not advocating that as a social policy, but I think at least the point is starting to get made.
Lee Eisenberg's new book, and it's all over the place now, is The Number, A Completely Different Way to Think About the Rest of Your Life. Mr. Eisenberg, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Alicia Monell, Director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Alicia, always good talking with you. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom, Lee.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.